I realized that here last night I started awakening to the truth that the presentation that we did in Idaho, the first six presentations is what that we did here, the first six presentations, and then we had in Idaho approximately, I think, seven other presentations just on subjects in Daniel. And that was part one. And then we went to Blythe and recorded. This is all a recording process. We went to Blythe and we recorded about six or seven presentations on Daniel. And then we took up the last seven presentations here. And as I began the 1843 chart last night, I realized it's just not reasonable to try to walk through these notes the way that I had them set up, because there's just too much that I left out in preparation in terms of discussing the rum and the sir that we did last night. By the time we got to the 1843 chart in the Blythe presentation, everyone was familiar with those, and the Mari vision and the Chalzon vision. And there's two words in the book of Daniel that are translated as sanctuary, Mikdash and Kodesh, and they make a difference. Kodesh is always God's sanctuary. Mikdash can be God's sanctuary or pagan sanctuary. And once you're familiar with those, then you can easily go to a verse and draw some conclusions. But you have to do that groundwork, I think, in order to keep people up to speed on it. There's even another word that is sometimes missed, that Dabar. And you need to deal with that word. So there's a lot of preparation that I didn't do before we started the 1843 chart. So I'm gonna kind of go off the cuff here for the next two evenings, try to bring it together and make some points. I'm gonna stay on the same subject and the same intent. And the intent of the presentations were to show enough times that inspiration teaches that the Millerite time period is fulfilled to the very letter at the end of the world, that it's repeated, that once you recognize that, then the logic that we're suggesting is that we can go look at some of the important aspects of the Millerite movement and make an argument that they will have a parallel fulfillment here at the end. And what we're specifically pointing out at this time is that one of the components of the Millerite time period, that any fair analysis of the Millerite time period, you cannot take that chart out of the time period. I mean, they were divinely directed by passages in Scripture to produce this chart, and then inspiration in early writings specifically says this was directed by the hand of the Lord. Not only were they led by the Lord to produce it, then the Lord said, I am the one that put this chart together, and the figures on it are not to be changed. But at the same time, the Lord acknowledged that there was some errors in it. He wasn't saying he wanted to perpetuate the errors. He was saying that as you look back at this chart, you're going to have to make allowances for the year zero here. But some of you, I know one sister here at least this evening that hasn't been here for any of the presentations. And so we're not just for her, but we're going to recap some things. Here, right at the start, we looked at the parable of 10 virgins, and Sister White says the parable of 10 virgins has been and will be fulfilled to the very letter. And as Sister White describes the history of the parable of the 10 virgins, those of you that are here will acknowledge that she uses the three angels' messages of Revelation 14 to describe that history. The first angel's message, August 11, 1840. The second angel's message, June of 1842. The third angel's message, October 22nd, 1844. And as Sister White's identifying these three messages of Revelation 14, she directly ties them in to the parable of the 10 virgins. So the three angels' messages of Revelation 14, among other things, is describing the history of the Millerite time period from August 11th, 1840 to October 22nd, 1842. And so is the parable of the 10 virgins. It's two lines of prophecy that are dealing with the same history. And then we looked at the seven thunders. And this is a point I'd like to make in for some of you that may not have been here. In Revelation 10, verse 4, John has heard seven thunders utter sounds, and he's told to seal up what the seven thunders uttered. And when Sister White comments on the seven thunders, she says the seven thunders represent two things. She says it represents the history of 1840 to 1844, and she says it represents future events that will be disclosed in her order. So this is another place where inspiration is teaching that the Millerite time period is repeated again to the very letter at the end of the world. This, though, is a more important key in the sense that another line of prophecy where you can show that the Millerite history was fulfilled, but at the same time that prophecy is illustrating the end of the world, is Daniel chapter 12. Daniel chapter 12 talks about an increase of knowledge. The increase of knowledge in the Millerite time period was, it's illustrated on this chart. The knowledge they came to understand from the books of Daniel and Revelation was the increase of knowledge in the Millerite time period. That increase of knowledge came from the book of Daniel. And in that sense, Daniel stood in his lot. He stood in his place. There's a quote where Sister White says, when a man stands in his lot, he fulfills his purpose. Daniel stood in his lot. The book of Daniel fulfilled its purpose in the Millerite time period. But we're told that Daniel's book will fulfill its purpose also at the end of the world. And the increase of knowledge in the Millerite time period, when the book of Daniel fulfilled its purpose and Daniel stood in his lot, took place because Christ, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, unsealed the book of Daniel. So when you realize there was an unsealing in the Millerite time period, but the Millerite time period is repeated again to the very letter at the end of the world, then you have to ask yourself, what is it that is unsealed at the end of the world? And that takes you to Revelation 22, verse 10, where we're told the time is at hand. Unseal the prophecy of this book, the prophecy in Revelation. And the prophecy in Revelation that has been sealed up is the seven thunders at the end of the world. Just before human probation closes, the Lord is going to unseal the significance and the history, the events, the experience that took place from 1840 to 1844 in the Millerite time period. And at the same time, he's going to identify that that history illustrates the end of Adventism. Not simply does he reacquaint us with that history in the same passage in the seven thunders. He gives us the key to understand that the Millerite time period is repeated to the very letter. So once we looked at that, then we began to deal with this 1843 chart a little bit. And as I said, I just can't do it as we did it in Blythe because there's too much building blocks you need to put in place before you just easily go through these things. But what we've looked at so far, what we've taken time on the chart so far, is I'm suggesting that this chart is present truth once again here at the end of the world. And not so much that this is a chart that we're going to use as the Millerites and go out and do evangelism with. It's not present truth in that sense. It's present truth in the sense that here we are at the end of the world, and as Seventh-day Adventists, we no longer understand what the foundations of Adventism were. And that's not just me saying that. That is in fulfillment of Revelation 10, verse 4. The history of the Millerite time period was sealed up there. That's what verse 4 teaches. So we're no longer familiar with the foundational truths, and our message here at the end of the world has to do with the return of the papacy to take control of the world and the implementation of the Sunday laws. And what I'm suggesting is the truths that are represented here on this chart are the truths that allow the student of prophecy to understand the prophetic message at the end of the world. So in this sense, this chart, once again, has a present truth relevance for God's people at the end of the world. And on top of that, when Sister White is talking about this chart in Early Writings, page 74, and we've read the passage here a couple times at least already, when she's speaking about that, she says there were some things that were on this chart that people didn't recognize until what? Until the Lord had removed his hand. And the thought of the Lord removing his hand from this chart so we could see things, or so the pioneers could see things from this chart, to me is parallel to the Lord saying it's time to unseal the seven thunders. The Lord is actively bringing to light for his people the repeat of the Millerite history. And at the same time, He's removing his hand from some of the things on these charts, and there's things on this chart, and there are things on this chart that the pioneers did not understand, but they have a simple, it's a simple but profound message for us. Brothers and sisters, some of the things that you heard last night, they may have been the first time you heard them, and you may have went, wow, in your mind. But it's really simple. It's really simple. If we take the Lord at His word in early writings, page 74. I see someone writing that down. So let's read it to make sure that if you're one of those out there that may not have your own set of notes, we can put it in the record here this evening. There's a good place on page 77 in the syllabus where it has the complete quote from early writings that we deal with. And on the top of page 77 in the syllabus, it says September 23rd, and it goes into the paragraph. And I'm going to skip over that paragraph. I'm not skip over the paragraph, but skip over the first two-thirds of that paragraph. And the fourth line from the bottom of that first paragraph, Sister White says, I have seen that the 1843 chart was directed by the hand of the Lord, and that it should not be altered, that the figures were as He wanted them, and that His hand was over and hid a mistake in some of the figures, so that none could see it until His hand was removed. Then I saw, in relation to the daily, that the word sacrifice was supplied by man's wisdom and does not belong to the text, and that the Lord gave the correct view of it to those who gave the judgment hour cry. When union existed before 1844, nearly all were united on the correct view of the daily, but in the confusion since 1844, other views have been embraced, and darkness and confusion have followed. Time has not been a test since 1844, and it never again will be a test. We dealt with a little bit last night, the year 508. The pioneers understood that the daily was paganism. If you look closely, the man in history that first identified the daily in the book of Daniel as paganism was a man named William Miller. Before the day and age of William Miller, the Protestant world identified the daily in the book of Daniel as what? Christ's sanctuary ministry. So when William Miller comes to a different conclusion in that time period, he's opposing the whole Protestant world. And one of the things, if you read his comments on the daily, he says, I found that the word continual that's translated as daily in the book of Daniel, he says, I found that it's found nowhere else in the Bible. And yet today in Adventism, the modern theologians point out that the Hebrew word continual is found over and over again in the Bible, especially in connection with the sanctuary service. You know, the continual offering, that word continual is the same word. But William Miller said, I found that this word continual is only found in the book of Daniel. And you know something? William Miller was right. The word that is expressed as continual in the book of Daniel is only found in the book of Daniel, because where it's found in other parts of the Bible, it's used as an adjective or an adverb, and I'm not good on my grammatical definitions. Whereas in the book of Daniel, it's a subject, it's a noun. It's used totally different, and it's only used that way in the book of Daniel. And Seventh-day Adventists are called to be those that proclaim the fourth angel's message. And the fourth angel's message, we've looked at two parts, but part A, verses 1 through 3 of Revelation 18, is a description of Babylon. If you go read the verse 3 verses of Revelation 18 and you approach it from that view, you'll see, yeah, the first part is a description of Babylon, and then verses 4 and 5 is a call out of Babylon. So, Seventh-day Adventists, we in this room, one of our purposes in the world is to give the fourth angel's message. And if the message is a description of Babylon, then we should be the experts on Babylon, right? And Babylon, in Revelation 16, at the end of the world, comes in three parts. The dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. So we should know more about these three powers than anyone else. I would submit to you, if we're the ones that are going to give the description and call people out of her. And the dragon power, it comes into history at the Tower of Babel. And this is the Tower of Babel. And we can call it paganism, heathenism, spiritualism, whatever you want to call it. But there in Shinar, in Nimrod Shinar, paganism comes into the history of the world. And the Old Testament deals with paganism's temptations and attacks on God and His people. That's what it's all about. The Old Testament is the struggle against the religion of Nimrod that we know as paganism or heathenism. But there comes a point in time, and this is a big subject in the book of Daniel, when the religion of paganism is going to take a lower priority to the new religion that comes into the new satanic religion that comes into history in 538. And I understand there's a history of the papacy before 538, but I'm just taking a marker for this purpose. So paganism has been warring against God's people throughout history, and then in 538 a new power comes into history that's going to war against God's people for 1260 years and beyond. And about the time the papacy receives its deadly wound in 1776, we see the United States, the false prophet, coming into history to war against God's people. At the beginning of the world, there was only one power. If you were going to talk about Babylon in the time of Nimrod, it was just one part. If you're going to talk about Babylon in the 6th and 7th century, you can make a case that it was two parts. It was paganism and papalism. But at the end of the world, Babylon comes in three parts. That's what Revelation 16 is saying. It's spiritualism, Catholicism, and apostate Protestantism. The Hebrew word that Daniel uses to describe paganism that's translated as daily in the book of Daniel is continual. And paganism is the power that has continually warred against God and His people down through history. So the selection of that word by Daniel is accurate. And then you'll find in the book of Daniel, every time you find the word daily there, you'll see connected to it one word. What is it? Sacrifice. Sacrifice. And we just read in Early Writing 74 that Sister White says that was a supplied word and it does not belong to the text. So I ask you this question. I always try to ask this question just to think about it in a different direction. How many supplied words are there in the Bible? Hundreds. Hundreds, correct? Every italicized word is a supply word. So how many supplied words in the Bible has inspiration taken the time to tell us this one doesn't belong there? Only one. You know, when it comes to the daily in the book of Daniel, inspiration says, don't use the word sacrifice, because when you put the word sacrifice with it, that's one of the biggest stumbling blocks for this modern idea that this is representing Christ's work in the sanctuary above, because He continually ministers for us. But the fact that inspiration says don't put that word sacrifice in there, that's another argument that this isn't about Christ's sanctuary ministry above. And so, in her endorsement in Early Writing 74 of this chart, she also gives an endorsement on William Miller's understanding of the daily and the pioneer's understanding of the daily. And as we looked at yesterday, in Daniel 12, verse 10, where it says, and from the time that the daily is taken away, verse 11, and from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, the word that's translated take away there is sir, it means remove. The pioneers understood that time period to be 508. Why? Why? Because these seven European kings on this chart, they were going to come into a church-state relationship with the papacy in order to remove these three horns, the Heruli, the Ostrogoths, and the Vandal. It's on this chart. This is part of the foundational understanding. And in order for these seven European kings to come into church-state alliance with the papacy and go to war against these three powers, as they came into church-state alliance with the papacy, they legally changed their religious profession of their countries, one by one, from paganism to Catholicism. The first to do so was France in 496. And one by one, all seven of those European kings did so. and the last of the seven European kings to come into church-state relationship with the papacy and change the legal profession of its country from paganism to Catholicism was King Arthur of England in the year 508. So when verse 11 says, and from the time that the daily is removed, it's saying from the time that paganism, as the legal profession of these seven European kings, has been removed, there will be 1,290 days. And you'll notice, if you read it, from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, and the abomination that maketh desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. That this prophecy here in verse 11 is dealing with the setting up and the placing of the papacy on the throne of the earth. So the fact that it ends in 1798, the time prophecy is directly connected to the papacy. And then it says, blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to the 1,305 days. And starting at 508, you come to 1843. And the blessing of 1843 is associated with the Millerite movement coming to the final purification process, because it's very clear, one of the truths of 1840 to 1844 that Sister White emphasizes, that history attests to, is that there was a progressive purification process going on in those years. Early writings, page 259, said if you didn't accept William Miller's message, you weren't even around when the organized churches closed their door. If you accept William Miller's message, then when the organized churches closed their door in 1842, you had another test. And if you've stayed, then you were going to be tested by the first disappointment and the tarrying time. Then you were going to be tested by the midnight cry. It was a progressive test. But when you came to 1843, you had reached the point where the call into the marriage was given, and Revelation 19:9 says, blessed is he who is called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And we read a quote the other day from Great Controversy where Sister White says, the marriage of the parable of the ten virgins and the coming of to the temple by the, not the prince of the covenant, what's Malachi say? The messenger of the covenant, I think he says. And the Day of Atonement, she ties all those together. The marriage began on October 22nd, 1844. And there had to be a call to the marriage that precedes the marriage. You don't send out your wedding announcements on the very day that the wedding takes place. And the call was 1843. That's why it says, blessed is he who comes to the 1,335 days. So the pioneers, they had this correct. They had this correct. And they had the 2520 correct, but they just had it partially correct. And I didn't realize it. Probably all of you have realized it, but I didn't think that I had included in the notes that we prepared for Colton all of Hiram Edson's articles. But if you purchase those notes, then you have all of Hiram Edson's articles in these notes. And Hiram Edson's articles are based on this time prophecy right here. William Miller, go ahead. Yep, and they're in the Colton notes as well. Up here, on based on 2 Chronicles 33:11, William Miller suggested that in 677, that the southern kingdom of Israel, remember Israel's divided into two kingdoms, when Manasseh was carried into Babylon by the Assyrians, that this was the starting point of the 2,520-year time prophecy that is mentioned four times in Leviticus 26. But this time prophecy, this has, on this chart, it has William Miller's error, because it started before the year zero, and William Miller was incorrect on the year zero, just like he was incorrect on the year zero of the 2,300-year time prophecy. So if you account for William Miller's error, what is reflected on this chart, the 1843, starting at 677, mathematically is 1844. So what William Miller was saying is that the 2,520-year time prophecy that's mentioned four times in Leviticus 26, it began when the southern kingdom was first carried into captivity in 677, and this time period extended all the way to 1844. Miller thought 1843. But remember, that's what William Miller was seeing in everything. He was seeing 1843 for the 1335 days. He was seeing 1843 for the 2300 days. He was seeing 1843 for the 2520. You know, he was just locked on 1843 for... And I understand that was divinely ordained, right? Sister White plainly says that mistake was part of the process of purification. Yeah. He wasn't going to see beyond that in no way at all. That was the return of Christ.
When you subtract 1844 minus 677, you know, we are uneven in that number, isn't it?
No.
We say that it's because of the year zero or something like that. But you never, when you subtract, you never take care of that zero because that never exists.
So what are you saying? You're saying 1843 is correct?
1843 minus 677 gives you 2520. But when you go to 1844, it gives you one more number.
Okay. Let's work this through. If you look at this long enough, you always arrive at that thought. And it sometimes is even difficult for me to work this through, but follow me on this, all right? If it's a 2520-year time prophecy, and you're going to subtract 677 from it, then you come to 1843, correct? So, if you start at the year 1, okay? 1 AD. Okay, 1 AD. 1 AD, all right? And you add... There's a way to do this that's simple. I figured it out before. I've done it before. If you take 677 and bring it down into history to the year zero, then you've used up 677 years, right? It takes 677 from 677 to equal zero, right? But the year before the year zero is 1 BC, and the year after the year zero is 1 AD, correct? And there is no year zero. So where you really end up at when you take 677 is you end up at the year 1 AD. You understand that logic? So do you understand that logic? That's point one. When you take 677 out of the history, then you end up in the year 1 AD. If you then take 677 from 2520, you have 1843, and you have to add 1 year, 1 AD. Because 1843 didn't begin at the year zero. It began at the year one. Okay, is everyone straight on that? And it's probably easier for you than me, but I mean it works. It's well, you don't need to acknowledge that to do the simple math.
No, but that's what the math is showing. They have to go the full year gone.
So, I want to keep it as simple as possible without putting too much complexity into it. So, in the Hiram Edson articles, brothers and sisters, in 1856, I've been saying 1850, but in 1856, because James White asked Hiram Edson to contribute some articles, Hiram Edson went back in to this 2520-year prophecy of Leviticus 26, and he said, William Miller was wrong. He says there wasn't, in 1843... there wasn't any historical event that corresponded to the what you would expect at the end of this time prophecy. And therefore, what he did is he went into the history when the northern kingdom was taken into captivity. And the northern kingdom was taken into captivity first. So he's making an argument that if you're going to start this 2,520-year time prophecy, which is a time period of indignation against God's people, God is cursing his people with punishment for 2,520 years, then what the argument of Hiram Edson is that you need to begin this time prophecy when Israel is first carried into captivity, and that would be the northern kingdom in the year 723. And if you start that here, and then you project it out 2,520 years, you come to 1798. And you have the articles by Hiram Edson, and you can see there's a lot of prophetic conclusions that you draw from that. One of them that is very significant is that the pioneers, if you take your time to look closely and understand what the pioneers understood about the book of Daniel, one of the foundational understandings on the book of Daniel that the pioneers recognized that is in the book of Daniel, there were two desolating powers. That's why it was so clear for them that the daily represented paganism and the abomination of desolation represented papalism, because they were dealing with those two desolating powers. It was part of their philosophical, basic philosophical understanding of the book of Daniel. So when Hiram Edson identifies the 2520 as starting in 723 and ending in 1798, he comes across an argument in support of these two desolating powers that's just profound, because the middle is the year 538, and suddenly you see in the 2520 a 1260-year time period that paganism would trample down God and his people, followed by a 1260-year time period that the papacy would trample down God's people. And that is in agreement with the arguments that the pioneers have about the book of Daniel, is that it's two powers, two desolating powers, and they deal with it in a lot of verses. Doesn't it seem warm in here? Okay, that's good. I don't want to be thinking I was getting a fever. So, once you understand that we're going over this, I'm going over this on purpose, so you just get it in your head, and it's really not that hard. It's pretty simple. And once you have this much in your head, there is much to say about these two time prophecies. There's much information to be gleaned from these, but I believe first you have to settle in to see that they really fit. I mean, that this really works. This is the type of thing that cannot be an accident.
The first 1260 then is pagan.
Yeah.
And the second is
pagan. Yeah. It's an argument about the two desolating powers that the pioneers never... No one made the argument until Hiram Edson comes along, all right, in 1856. So the next thing that I want you to see is that Hiram Edson said William Miller was wrong. You know, that's why he was doing this study. He was saying, no, up here on this chart, William Miller was wrong. And then his conclusion is right. And what we're saying is no, Hiram Edson was wrong, because they were both right. They were both right, because if I rob a bank and the punishment is 10 years, I get 10 years in jail. If 10 years later you rob a bank, you get the same punishment, 10 years in jail. The northern kingdom broke the covenant, and their punishment was 2,520 years of indignation. When the southern kingdom broke the covenant, they got the same punishment, 2,520 years. Okay. God is no respecter of persons. So once you see that, then you realize that, yes, William Miller was right and Hiram Edson was right. They were both right. Same punishment for both the southern and the northern kingdom. This is something the pioneers have never acknowledged. Anyway. 1798, here's the next step, leaving out a lot of things to say. If you take 1798 as the end of the first indignation, in 1844 as the end of the last indignation, and you subtract them, you have 46 years. All right? Right? Simple math. If you look closely at the history of the 2300-year prophecy, we know that the 2300-year prophecy began in 457. This is the foundation of Adventism, right? We also know that this time prophecy began on the third decree, right? So this 457, third decree, that's the seven. There were two decrees before it. But the beginning of this time prophecy says that it would take 7 weeks, 49 years, for what to happen? The streets and the walls would be rebuilt even in troublous times, correct? So the first part of this 2300-year time prophecy was identifying how long it would take for the total construction of Jerusalem to be completed. Everyone with me on that? Okay. Yes? Say amen if you're following my logic. Okay. If you go into Prophets and Kings and you look closely, Sister White speaks about Ezra being there at the third decree. And when she's talking about Ezra realizing that very few people came out of Babylon on the third decree, within a couple paragraphs she points out that the temple had already been completely built by the third decree. The temple was finished by 457. All right? They still had to rebuild the streets and the walls. But there's another historical figure associated with rebuilding the streets and the walls. And who is that?
Nehemiah.
Nehemiah, the first thing he does before he comes back to finish the work is what? He secures a decree from the king. There is really four decrees at the beginning of the 2300-day prophecy. It begins at the third decree, but the work is finished under the fourth decree. This isn't an accident. You have the first, second, and third angel's message, decree. On the third message, the 2300-year prophecy ends. All right? What we're waiting for now is the fourth angel's message when the work of rebuilding spiritual Jerusalem is finished, and that work is prefigured by Nehemiah. So what I want you to see, and there are several quotes, there are several places where Sister White says the work of rebuilding and restoring Jerusalem in this history, rebuilding literal Jerusalem, represents the work of Seventh-day Adventists in rebuilding spiritual Jerusalem. She says that more than once. So you have inspired references that the beginning history of the 2300 days is identifying our history, and our history is the history of the Millerite time period that's also repeated to the very letter at the end of the world. So, I mean, this is right on target with what we're looking at. You follow the logic? Follow the logic so far? So, when you go in to... Let me throw one more. I might lose you here. Don't want to lose you, but I might lose you here because this is a very... I'm going to shrink down a study that we have. If you haven't ever looked at the study that we present called The Prophetic Pattern, this is from The Prophetic Pattern, okay? And that's like a 10-hour study, and I'm going to give you about 3 minutes of it here. In early writings, page 259, and other places, Sister White is clear that in the Millerite time period is over here, okay? 1844, third angel's message comes into history. 1840, first angel's message comes in history. And in early writing, Sister White is clear that there's a threefold testing process in the Millerite time period. She has a paragraph when she describes it. But the paragraph before it, in early writings, page 259, she parallels this history of the Millerites with the history of Christ and talks about a threefold testing process in the history of Christ. Now, you can't just use early writings, page 259, to demonstrate everything I'm going to show you here. But in the prophetic pattern, there's other passages in the spirit of prophecy that will uphold what I'm going to say. And here's what I'm going to say. In the history of Christ, the third test that parallels the third message in 1844 or the third decree that begins the 2300 days is the cross. the cross parallels October 22nd, 1844. That is why when Sister White describes the disappointment that follows October 22nd, 1844, she goes back to the history right after the cross and uses the disappointment of the disciples. And that is why when you're reading in Prophets and Kings about this history with Ezra, she says that Ezra saw that the numbers that came out of Babylon was disappointingly, that's her word, small. There's a disappointment right here. There's a disappointment illustrated about after the third decree, after the third test in the days of Christ, after the third message. Right in here in the Millerite time period, you have the midnight cry. And what history does Sister White use to illustrate the midnight cry? Right in here, the triumphal entry. She uses the triumphal entry to illustrate the midnight cry. And in the second angel's message, the organized churches close their doors against Christ. And when you look closely at the time period of Christ, the second test for them is when the Jews decided it was expedient that one should die and the whole nation not perish. And Sister White compares William Miller with John the Baptist. And then we know that after the cross, what do we have? We have Pentecost, which is prefiguring the latter rain, which is prefigured by the work of Nehemiah. This pattern, you can show this pattern throughout the scriptures. And what this pattern is, I'm going to spend just a minute on the pattern and then come back to the 25:20. When you put these patterns together in inspiration, you find that the first waymark, the first message, is a reform message. It's brought by a reformer. The second one is a visual illustration, a test that has some kind of visual component to it. The third represents some type of judgment, all right? The third decree, the judgment hour prophecy begins. At the cross, the third test in the time of Christ, Satan and the world are judged. On this third decree, the investigative judgment begins. So, if to give you an example of how many other places this pattern occurs, Moses brought a reform message to the children of Israel in the story of their deliverance from Egypt. And we know this is so because he had them quit working on Sabbath. And this infuriated Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said, okay, double the amount of bricks and let them go start gathering their own straw to make the bricks. Because he brought a Sabbath reform message. So the process here in the days of Moses, this pattern's there just airtight. And then the next waymark will be a visual waymark connected to a mighty movement of the Holy Spirit. The midnight cries in the second test, the closing of the doors, the triumphal entry, and the plagues that were poured out on Egypt is the second marker in the story of Moses. And then the third is when judgment was brought upon the firstborn. And then 50 days later, where's Moses? Fifty days after Passover. What does 50 mean? Sinai, Pentecost. Pentecost, 50 days later. Notice how this Pentecost lines up with this Pentecost, and the Passover lines up with the cross. And, of course, Moses' reform lines up with John the Baptist. It all lines up. It all lines up. This pattern is throughout Scripture. All right? There's not an accident here. In fact, there's one place where Sister White's identifying the disappointment of the Millerites on October 23rd, 1844, and what history does she go to? She says that when the Jews, after Passover, found themselves with the Red Sea in front of them and Pharaoh's army behind them, they were find many of these references in the study that we have called the prophetic pattern, because I'm all of these are very well defendable in inspiration. There's lots of quotes to back this up. So then there's more to be said about this pattern, but I want you to see this pattern. Do you see the pattern? Okay.
The 457 pattern, what happened there that illustrates the other ones also? What happened there?
In 457, you have the beginning of... Yeah, there's more to be said, but I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time here. You have the beginning of the judgment hour prophecy. So you have the third decree is associated with judgment, just like the cross is judgment. The 1844 is judgment. If you go into the Bible and the spirit of prophecy, then this may, you may not catch this, but this is pretty profound. If you go into the Bible and the spirit of prophecy, when the Bible or the spirit of prophecy is speaking of the three decrees that were delivered to bring the children out of Babylon, the children of Israel out of Babylon, there is only one of the decrees where it's ever mentioned, come out of Babylon. Just one of the decrees actually uses the word come out of Babylon. Which decree do you suppose it is? It's the second one. When the Bible or the spirit of prophecy talks about the first decree, it never uses the phrase come out of Babylon. When it talks about the third decree, it never uses the phrase come out of Babylon. But when it talks about the second decree, it talks about come out of Babylon. What's the message of the second angel? Come out of Babylon. That's not an accident. So you can show, you know, that this history is, it's not accidental. So my point is this, here's where we're going. There were 46 years before the third decree that were used to build the temple. Why do I say 46 years? We read it last night, but let's look at it again. John 2:20. Now, there was 46 years here at the beginning to build the literal temple at the beginning of the 2300-day prophecy. And then in John, let's start with verse 19. Let's start with verse 18. Then answered the Jews and said unto him, unto Christ, what sign showest thou unto us, seeing that thou doest these things? Jesus answered and said unto them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Then said the Jews, 46 years was this temple in the building, and wilt thou rear it up in 3 days? So we know it was 46 years before the third decree that the literal temple was raised up. And brothers and sisters, the spiritual temple was raised up from 1798 to 1844 as identified by the 2:25:20 prophecies. If you take the end of the first indignation, you subtract it from the end of the last indignation, you have 46 years from 1798, somewhere in here, so to speak, until here, 1844. You also have 46 years. You have 46 years prior to the third decree. You have 46 years prior to the end of the 2300 days. The 46 years at the beginning was to build the literal temple. This 46 years is to raise up the spiritual temple, and on October 22nd, 1844, the Lord raised up Adventism, His second denominated people. He entered into a covenant with His people again. He married a people again, just as He married Israel at Sinai. And remember, we know He married Israel at Sinai because in AD 34, Israel was divorced of God at the stoning of Stephen, and you have to be married to be divorced. All of this was repeated here on October 22nd, 1844. And so this is an argument. It's not an accident that the 2520 comes in two places and it's 46 years apart from 1798 to 1844. Those can't be accidents. But let me show you one more thing, if you will, and we'll get off this. It's right in this history here. Now this is... Sometimes it's easy for me to accept theoretical things in prophecy, and maybe it's a weakness of mine and it's incorrect, but I know sometimes it's a little bit harder for others to readily accept some of the theoretical stuff. But I want to throw one more thing at you. At the beginning of the 2300 years, you had 46 years erecting the temple. At the end, you have 46 years erecting the temple, right on in perfect alignment. But in the history of the middle of the 2300 years, the history of the cross, where you also have this 3-1 combination, you have the argument that takes place that we just read.
between the Jews and Christ. So you have in this history the 46 years also acknowledged. It's part of that history, and it's not a minor part of that history. Because if you're still in John 2, when Jesus said in verse 19, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up, put that verse into the Ellen White CD-ROM and you find that this is the argument the Jews used to crucify Christ. And this argument is directly connected to the 46 years of raising up the temple. Yes. It's going to be cut off. Now, and what he's talking about is the explanation of the 2300 year prophecy in Daniel 9 that Gabriel comes and gives to Daniel, and Messiah is going to be cut off in the midst of the week. He's talking about that very thing. And in Daniel's prayer in Daniel 9, we looked at it yesterday. The whole prayer is built upon the curse, the indignation that's brought against Israel in fulfillment of Leviticus 26. So you just can't separate this 25:20 out of the book of Daniel.
So WAD minus 34 AD is 46 years.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh.
Is it?
70 AD. What happened in 70 AD? What happened in 34?
The end of the probation.
46 years. There's 46 years in there. It's not just a discussion of the 46 years. There's 46 years in this history, brothers and sisters. And it has to do also with the same theme that this is the end of the city of the temple and this is the end of the denominated people, the divorce. The divorce is here in 34, and the trampling down is in 80-70, and the two 25-20s, one of them is talking about the divorce, and one of them is talking about the trampling down. So, thoughts are coming too fast to follow up on this. But, brothers and sisters, part of what we're suggesting here, and what we believe, is that the line of the tribe of Judah is unsealing the seven thunders right now. And he's moving his hand away from this chart. And the reason for that, there's more to be said about this. But I can't make a complete defense of this, but I want to say this for you. When you begin to look at the beginning of Adventism and the end of Adventism, you always find a backslidden time period between the third and the fourth message. Here they ceased building the temple. In the story of Moses, in that time period, what did the children of Israel do?
By the way, that's 36 years.
26? Okay, that's 36. Take that off the record. We will uphold the argument here, though, about the 46 years in the heart of this. We got a little bit sidetracked there, but that's all right. It's sanctified speculation in unfolding prophecy is totally acceptable. Okay, now.
But I can show you one little detail that I've had correct. Nehemiah's decree was 445 B.C.
440? That's getting too obscure, even if it's true. I follow your logic. Yeah, I'm not erasing that date. I know, but I'm not. This is one of those tapes that the brethren that want to hang you out to dry on, they're going to use this one. But that's all right. We've been hung out to dry before. The history of the second angel's message is prefiguring the history of the fourth angel's message. The pioneer time period is prefiguring our time period. And one of the truths that is established in prophecy when you look at these two time periods. And in the last time we were out here in this church, we mentioned this, and you'll see it in your notes, but we're not going to get to those. Is that in the story of Zechariah, Zechariah employs Zerubbabel as a symbol of one that lays the foundation of the work and puts the capstone on the work. And Zerubbabel, meaning offspring of Babylon, and it can be understood as out of Babylon. Zerubbabel is a symbol of the beginning of Adventism and the end of Adventism. And in the book of Haggai, it says Zerubbabel is a signet in the Lord's hand, and the signet is a seal. Zerubbabel is symbolizing the sealing that took place during the midnight cry. And I know that might seem strange, but that was a sealing process at the beginning of Adventism that was going on. And when Sister White speaks about the time period of the midnight cry later on, she says anyone that participated in the midnight cry, she says, as they look back at that time, they can never forget it. They can never wipe it out of their memory. What went on during that time period was pointing forward to, it was a type of the sealing Latter-rain time period during the fourth angel's message, of which Zerubbabel is also a symbol. So, my point is this. Nehemiah is a symbol of this. And if you look at Nehemiah, when Nehemiah went to work, when he got the decree and he came to Jerusalem and he was going to go to work, what's the first thing he did? They checked out the place. He walked around Jerusalem, and was it in good shape? It was in bad shape. And Nehemiah first took in all the things that needed to be dealt with. So when you get down here to the fourth angel's time period, when the Millerite time period is repeated, there's going to be a lot of problems in Jerusalem. This wall is going to be broken down. This wall is going to be totally gone. And one of the truths that Seventh-day Adventists will need to understand here at this time period, when the Lord's raising up the 144,000, is who and what they are. Who we are. And brothers and sisters, we're modern Israel. We entered into a marriage with the Lord in 1844. We are His covenant people. We are the ones that are to defend and define and explain the law. We're the ones that are supposed to clarify the prophetic message. We are a special people. And it's hard to say that now. It's hard to live in the culture of Adventism today and see that or say it. It just is. Particularly some of those, like my wife and I, who came into Adventism out of the world, and everything we understand about the glories of Adventism is totally from the history books. You know, we've been in I know you're in the struggle too, but we've been in a struggle in this culture just like everyone else. And one of the ways the Lord intends to awaken us to our responsibility as the 144,000 is to nail down clearly from Bible prophecy who we are. We are the people that entered into the covenant relationship back here in the beginning when Zerubbabel laid the foundation of the work, and Zerubbabel's going to finish the work. He's going to put the capstone on the work. So when you look at that in depth, and we didn't look it in depth, I'm just talking it off the top of my head, but when you look at this truth in prophecy, you can make a case that when you reach the point in time when these truths are also beginning to be understood, that you're at the end of the world.
There's only been two covenant peoples throughout the entire history of the world.
That's right. The first was entered into covenant in Sinai. The second, October 22nd, 1844. And Sister White never refers to the Christian people from the stoning of Stephen until October 24th as God's denominated people. She never does that. God's denominated people is Adventism from 1844 onward. And it was ancient Israel until the stoning of Stephen. We're a special people above all others. We're His peculiar treasure. We're the priests. Yes, when Nehemiah... there's a very nice compilation on Nehemiah that every Seventh-day Adventist should read through. And the responsibility of every Seventh-day Adventist is to walk around the walls of Jerusalem. First in your home. Where's this wall broken down? Where's that wall broken down in your home? And then within your wider home, your church family, in order to intelligently relate to the situation. But once you get to that point, the one thing you have to remember, don't get on off the wall. Once you're on the wall checking it out, don't get down for anything. Stay on the wall. Right. That's true. That's true. So maybe we shouldn't have talked about that. Yeah, there is. Yeah, wise as serpents, harmless as doves. So let's take a break, and then when we come back, we're going to have a prayer time to open with to kind of acknowledge prayer meeting here. But let's end with prayer at this time.